When the lights go out, they speak. The vanished, the cursed, the cruel. Their echoes live here. I'm Raven Vale, and you've just crossed the threshold. Welcome to Whispers from the Dark. Welcome to Whispers from the Dark. Tonight's episode, The Manufactured Memory. Can your mind be rewritten without you knowing? Think about your earliest memory. Go ahead. Take a second. Maybe it's a birthday, a smell, a voice, a room you haven't stood in for decades, a face you can still see clearly, even though the person who owned it has been gone for years. It feels real, doesn't it? More than real. It feels like bedrock. Like something you could reach into the dark and find exactly where you left it. Certain. Solid. Yours. But what if it isn't? What if that memory was never yours to begin with? What if somewhere between the moment it was formed and the moment you just recalled it, something changed? What if something was added that wasn't there before? What if something was taken out? What if the memory you just reached for isn't a record of something that happened, but a construction of something that was built? Carefully, deliberately, without you ever knowing. I'm Raven Vale, and this is Whispers from the Dark. Tonight we're not exploring what you remember. We're exploring something far more unsettling than that. We're exploring what memory actually is, what it can be made to do, what it can be made to say, and what it means that the thing you trust most to tell you who you are can be rewritten while you're still living inside it. We trust our memories more than almost anything else, more than documents, more than photographs, more than the accounts of other people who were standing in the same room. Memory is the thing we go back to when everything else is in dispute. It defines who we are, where we've been, what we believe about the world and our place in it. It shapes our relationships, our fears, our sense of self. It gives continuity to a life that would otherwise feel like disconnected moments with no thread between them. Without memory, we don't just lose information. We lose the narrative. And without the narrative, we lose ourselves. This is why memory feels sacred. Why attacking someone's memory of an event can feel like a personal assault. Why you're remembering it wrong lands differently than almost any other disagreement. Because when you challenge someone's memory, you're not just challenging a fact, you're challenging their identity, their reliability, their relationship with what's real. Think about what it would mean if someone you trusted, your mother, your oldest friend, a therapist, sat across from you and said calmly, "That didn't happen the way you remember it." Or worse, "That didn't happen at all." Something about that lands in a different register than ordinary disagreement. It doesn't feel like a debate. It feels like an erasure. And most people's instinct in that moment isn't to examine the memory more carefully. It's to defend it. Because to surrender a memory, to admit that your mind generated something vivid and real and completely false, would require a kind of epistemic humility about your own inner experience that almost no one is naturally prepared to offer. We are not designed for that kind of doubt about our own perception. We are designed for confidence. And that confidence is exactly the vulnerability. But here is the problem. And it is a significant problem. Memory isn't a recording. It isn't a video file stored on a hard drive, waiting to be played back exactly as captured. It is not a photograph. It is not a transcript. It is reconstruction. Every single time you remember something, you are not replaying a stored event. You are rebuilding it from fragments, from impressions, from the emotional residue of an experience that your brain encoded imperfectly the first time, and has been altering gradually, invisibly, every time you've accessed it since. This is not a flaw. It's architecture. The human brain was not designed to be a recording device. It was designed to be a survival tool. And survival doesn't require perfect recall. It requires pattern recognition, emotional waiting, the ability to update, to revise, to incorporate new information into existing frameworks. The brain is adaptive, dynamic, constantly editing. And that capacity to edit is precisely what makes memory so vulnerable to interference. Because if memory is reconstruction, then anything that influences the reconstruction influences the memory. Consider the last time you told a story about something that happened to you. Something from years ago. You told it once, then again. Each time you told it, you edited slightly for your audience. You emphasized one detail. You softened another. You added a line that got a laugh or a pause that made the emotional beat land harder. And each time you told it, the version you told became the version you remembered. The original event, the raw, unprocessed experience, retreated further behind the polished narrative. Until eventually, you couldn't fully separate the event from the story you'd made of it. That is ordinary memory distortion. That happens to everyone. That is simply what memory does when left to its own devices. But what happens when memory isn't left to its own devices? What happens when the distortion is not accidental, but deliberate? That is the question that Elizabeth Loftus spent her career answering. And there is quite a lot that can influence the reconstruction. In the early 1990s, a cognitive psychologist named Elizabeth Loftus began asking a question that most of her colleagues found either obvious or impossible. Could you convince a person that something had happened to them when it never had? Not through force, not through confusion, not through the disorientation of trauma or illness, through suggestion alone, through the gentle, persistent introduction of information into the space where a memory should be. The answer she found changed everything we thought we understood about the reliability of human recollection. And it began with a mall. Participants in a series of studies were given written narratives about their own childhoods. The accounts were provided by family members. Most of them described real events, moments that had genuinely occurred. But one account, in every set, was fabricated. A story about being lost in a shopping mall as a young child, the panic of separation, the confusion of unfamiliar surroundings, the eventual relief of being found by a stranger and returned to family. An emotionally resonant experience. Plausible. The kind of thing that happens to children. The kind of thing a person might reasonably have forgotten. Participants were asked to write about each event, to try to recall whatever they could. At first, most of them noted that they had no memory of being lost in the mall. They weren't sure it had happened, but over repeated sessions, something shifted. People began to remember it, not just accept it, not just acknowledge that it might have occurred, remember it. They described the feeling of panic, the rows of unfamiliar stores, the moment they realized they couldn't find their family, the stranger who helped them, the relief, the emotion, in vivid, specific detail about something that never happened. Not to any of them. Not once. In study after study, Loftus and her colleagues found that between 20 and 40% of participants could be induced to form what are now called false memories. Not vague impressions. Not uncertain half-recollections. Fully formed, emotionally real, confidently held memories of events that were entirely invented. And when participants were later told the truth, many of them didn't believe it. They argued, they insisted, because the memory felt real. And when researchers pushed further, when the implanted events were more dramatic, more consequential, a frightening animal attack, a serious accident, a medical procedure, the false memories that formed were correspondingly more vivid, more detailed, more defended. The more emotional weight a false memory carried, the more real it felt, the more impossible it was to surrender. Because to the brain that built it, feeling real and being real are the same thing. Loftus didn't stop there. She turned next to a courtroom, or rather, to the research that ought to have been foundational to every courtroom, but wasn't. Eyewitness testimony, the gold standard of criminal evidence for most of human legal history, the thing juries trust most, the thing that has sent more people to prison than almost any other form of evidence. She began asking what happened to a memory between the moment an event occurred and the moment a witness recounted it under oath. What she found was alarming to everyone who preferred a simpler picture of how justice works. Witnesses who were asked leading questions about what they had seen incorporated the assumptions embedded in those questions into their subsequent recollections. A witness asked, "How fast was the car going when it smashed into the other vehicle?" later remembered the collision as more severe than a witness asked the same question using the word "hit." One word in a single question. And the memory shifted. Not just the description of the memory itself. When tested later, the witness who had heard "smashed" was significantly more likely to report having seen broken glass at the scene. There was no broken glass. There had been no broken glass. The glass existed only in the memory that a single word had helped construct. This is not an edge case. This is how memory works, under normal conditions, in ordinary people. Without any intent to deceive or manipulate, just a word in a question. And the canvas received a new brush stroke. This is where the ground starts to shift beneath you. Because if a memory can be created from nothing, then what separates a real memory from a false one? What quality does a genuine recollection possess that a manufactured one does not? Emotion? Emotion can be attached to a suggestion as easily as to an experience. Detail. The brain fills in detail automatically. The more a false memory is rehearsed, the richer its sensory texture becomes. By the 10th time, you recall something that never happened. You can smell it. You can feel the temperature of the room. You can hear the ambient noise in the background. Confidence? Confidence is the most unreliable indicator of all. Research has shown repeatedly that the certainty with which a person holds a memory has almost no relationship to its accuracy. The most confidently recalled events are sometimes the most heavily reconstructed. The witnesses who testify with absolute certainty are sometimes the ones who are most completely wrong. Your brain does not label its contents. It does not tag a memory as verified or unverified, accurate or distorted, original or altered. It tags memories as familiar. And familiarity feels like truth. It feels like recognition. It feels like the sensation of arriving somewhere you have been before. And that feeling is indistinguishable from accuracy, which means that every time you remember something, you are trusting a system that cannot distinguish between what happened and what it has been told happened, between experience and suggestion, between the real and the constructed. You are trusting a canvas that has already been painted over. And in the 1980s and 1990s, that vulnerability had consequences that destroyed real lives. During those decades, a particular form of therapeutic practice became increasingly common. It operated under the belief that traumatic memories could be repressed, pushed below conscious awareness by the mind's protective mechanisms, hidden from the patient, but still present, still exerting influence, still shaping behavior, anxiety, relationship patterns, and psychological distress in ways the patient couldn't explain. The therapist's role within this framework was to help the patient retrieve those buried memories, to bring them to the surface, to allow them to be processed, integrated, and healed. The intention was genuine. The practitioners believed in what they were doing. The patients believed in what they were experiencing. And the memories that emerged were vivid, detailed, emotionally devastating. They described abuse, violence, experiences so traumatic the mind had sealed them away. And in some cases, those memories were real. Trauma does affect memory. The mechanisms of encoding under extreme stress are complex and still not fully understood. Certain events fragment during storage. Certain experiences are processed non-linearly. Intrusive recollection, flashback, and delayed surfacing of traumatic material are documented. Real phenomena that deserve to be taken seriously. The existence of false memories does not cancel the existence of real ones. That is a crucial distinction, and one that gets lost in the heat of these debates. But in a significant number of cases, the memories that emerged from these sessions were not real. They could not have been real. They described events that other evidence proved could not have occurred. Events that multiple witnesses, documents, and physical reality contradicted with overwhelming force. One woman recalled being part of a satanic ritual that would have required hundreds of participants and left physical evidence across several counties. No evidence existed. Another remembered abuse by a father who had been hospitalized, demonstrably, on every date the abuse was alleged to have occurred. A man recalled memories of a childhood in a house his family had never lived in, on a street that did not exist in the city he named. The memories were specific. They were detailed. They were held with total conviction. And they were entirely, provably false. And yet the patients who held them would have bet their lives on their reality. because the techniques used in those sessions were, whether intentionally or not, precisely the techniques that manufacture false memories. Suggestion, repetition, authority, emotional amplification. The therapist introduced the framework. This kind of thing happens. It might have happened to you. Let's explore that possibility together, and the brain, which does not require an actual event in order to construct a memory. Only the right materials presented in the right sequence did what it was designed to do. It built something. Something the patient experienced as real. Something they would have sworn to in a court of law. Something they did, in some cases, swear to in a court of law. Families were shattered. People were imprisoned on the testimony of memories that had been assembled in a therapist's office. Lives were altered beyond repair. Not because of malice, not because of fraud, but because of the intersection of sincere, therapeutic belief and neurological vulnerability. Because of the collision between a system that was searching for something and a brain that, when prompted correctly, will find it, whether it is there or not. This is how a memory is constructed. Not through a single dramatic moment of implantation. Not through anything that feels like deception from the inside. It begins with suggestion. An idea introduced into a receptive mind. Not forcefully. Gently. The way you might introduce a seed into soil. You don't push it in. You simply create the conditions. The idea doesn't need to be delivered as fact. It can be delivered as a question. Do you think it's possible that something like this might have happened? Have you ever considered that your difficulty with trust might trace back to something you've forgotten? Is it possible there are things from your past that you haven't fully accessed? A question doesn't assert. It invites. And an invitation is far more effective than a command. Because the mind that accepts an invitation believes it arrived there on its own. Then repetition. The idea is revisited. Returned to. Each return reinforces the neural pathway. Makes the idea more familiar. And familiarity, as we've established, is indistinguishable from truth. You can make almost anything feel real through sufficient repetition. A claim heard twice is evaluated skeptically. A claim heard 50 times begins to feel like common knowledge. A claim encountered so frequently that you can no longer remember a time before you knew it. Feels like something you've always understood. Something self-evident. Something that requires no examination, because it is simply the way things are. Then emotion. Attach feeling to the suggestion, and the brain begins to treat it as significant. Emotionally significant events are flagged for deeper encoding. The amygdala marks them for priority storage. They become more vivid, more retrievable, more present, more real. Then authority. The suggestion arrives from a source the mind trusts. A therapist, a parent, a journalist, a teacher, a platform that has delivered accurate information before. Trust lowers the brain's critical threshold. It reduces the scrutiny applied to incoming information. It opens a door that skepticism would otherwise keep closed. And through that door, everything else follows. Add all of these together, and the brain fills in the rest. It generates sensory detail. It constructs a narrative arc with beginning, middle, and emotional resolution. It places the event in time and space. It gives the memory texture, weight, and the specific quality of realness that only comes from something the mind has fully integrated. And eventually, the constructed memory becomes indistinguishable from the original one surrounding it. It takes its place in the sequence of your life. It shapes how you understand what happened to you, what was done to you, what you survived, who you became because of it. And it feels absolutely, completely, unquestionably real. Because to the brain that built it, it is. Now we step out of the laboratory, out of the therapist's office, out of the controlled, documented, peer-reviewed world of academic psychology, and into something darker. The question these findings invite is not simply a clinical one. It is not merely interesting. It is not contained within research papers and ethical debates. The question is this: if memory can be implanted, it can be weaponized. If it can be weaponized, it will be. And if history has taught us anything, it already has been. But before we get to programs and operations and the deliberate use of these mechanisms at scale, consider for a moment the more ordinary version. Consider how many decisions in your life were shaped by a memory that was reshaped by the telling. How many arguments have you had where two people who were both present for the same event remember it completely differently? Not one of them lying. Both of them certain. Both of them in possession of a memory that feels as solid and real as anything they've ever experienced. And both of them wrong in ways neither of them can see. Because the memory that each of them carries was reconstructed through the emotional filter of what each of them needed the event to mean. Who was wrong? Who was right? Who was the one who tried? Who was the one who failed? The memory arranged itself around the conclusion, and then it presented itself as the evidence for that conclusion. This is not exceptional. This is Tuesday. This is the operating condition of every mind you have ever disagreed with, and every mind that has ever disagreed with you. The difference between accidental memory distortion and deliberate memory manipulation is the presence of someone who knows how the mechanism works and decides to use it. For decades, questions have circulated around government-sponsored research into psychological manipulation. Not theoretical, not speculative, documented, declassified, admitted. In the 1970s, congressional hearings confirmed the existence of programs that had explored the outer limits of what could be done to the human mind. Programs that investigated hypnosis, chemical influence, sensory deprivation, sleep disruption, and psychological conditioning as tools of interrogation, persuasion, and control. The documentation that survived, after significant portions were destroyed before investigators could reach them, revealed experiments conducted on subjects who had not consented. Patients in hospitals, prisoners, individuals who had no idea what was being done to them or why. The official record ends at a certain point. The programs were shut down. The oversight committees issued their reports, and the consensus settled into a comfortable place. That it happened, that it was wrong, that it is over. But the question that never fully closes is not whether those specific programs continued. It is whether the knowledge they generated disappeared with them. Because knowledge doesn't work that way. Understanding the mechanism by which a human mind can be destabilized, redirected, or rewritten, is not information that vanishes when a program is terminated. It transfers, it evolves, it finds new applications. And in the decades since those hearings, the tools available for psychological influence have not become less sophisticated. They have become immeasurably more so. Today, we do not need isolated programs operating in classified facilities. We do not need white rooms and chemicals and carefully controlled environments. We have something more efficient, something more scalable, something that operates continuously, voluntarily, and at a scale those earlier programs could never have imagined. We have information architecture. We have algorithms designed to understand not just what you click, but what you respond to emotionally. What makes your pulse change? What holds your attention past the point where you intended to stop scrolling? What triggers the particular combination of anxiety and outrage and validation that keeps you engaged? These systems are not neutral. They are not simply delivering information. They are curating reality. They are selecting, out of the vast and contradictory mass of human experience and event and interpretation, the narrow slice most calibrated to produce a specific emotional response in a specific person at a specific moment. And they deliver it in precisely the conditions that manufacture memory. We have recommendation systems that shape the stories you encounter, the voices you hear, the version of events that appears most frequently in your peripheral vision until it feels like consensus, until the thing being argued on the fringe starts to feel like the thing that reasonable people in the center have always believed, until the version you encounter most becomes the version that feels most familiar. And familiar, as we keep returning to, feels like true. We have repetition at a velocity that the brain was never designed to evaluate critically, because the brain's fact-checking mechanism requires time. It requires rest. It requires the friction of encountering perspectives and evidence that complicate the simple story. It requires exposure to people who remember the same events differently, who are in the same room and came away with different impressions, who hold different pieces of the larger picture. And that friction has been deliberately engineered out of most modern information environments. What replaced it is a seamless, personalized, emotionally resonant stream of content that confirms what you already half believe, reinforces it with the testimony of voices that sound like yours, adds detail and texture and emotional weight, attaches outrage and fear and the particular satisfaction of being on the right side of a clear moral divide, and eventually makes it feel like memory. Like something you already knew. Like something so obvious and self-evident that you can no longer remember a time when you didn't know it. That is not a conspiracy. That is a business model. And it operates on precisely the same mechanisms that Elizabeth Loftus documented in a psychology laboratory in the 1990s. Suggestion, repetition, emotional amplification, authority. The inputs are different. The delivery system is different. The output is the same. A belief so deeply held it feels like personal history. A certainty so complete that challenging it doesn't feel like disagreement. It feels like an attack. Right now, you are carrying memories. Some of them are accurate. Some of them have been distorted by time, by retelling, by the emotional context in which you've revisited them. Some of them may contain elements that were never part of the original experience at all. An impression absorbed from a story someone told you. A detail borrowed from a photograph taken at the same event. A feeling attached to a memory of a feeling, rather than to the event itself. And some of them may have been shaped by sources you never consciously registered, by narratives you encountered so frequently they became part of your internal landscape, by framings of events that you absorbed before you had the context to evaluate them, by the slow, patient work of influence operating on a mind that had no idea it was being influenced. None of this makes you weak. None of this makes you uniquely susceptible. It makes you human. It makes you a person whose mind works exactly the way all human minds work. The question is what you do with that knowledge, because there is a version of this episode that leads to paralysis, that makes you distrust every thought, interrogate every recollection, and spiral into a kind of epistemic nihilism where nothing can be known and nothing can be trusted. That is not the destination. The destination is something more useful than that. It is the ability to hold memory with a measure of curiosity rather than purely with certainty. To ask when a recollection feels particularly vivid or a conviction feels particularly unquestionable. Not just what it says, but where it came from. Once a false memory is accepted, it doesn't remain static. It integrates. It becomes part of the architecture of your identity. You begin to make decisions based on it. You form beliefs that rest on it. You build relationships, positions, and convictions that would crumble if the foundation were removed. And so when the foundation is questioned, the mind does not investigate. It defends. Because rejecting the memory doesn't just mean admitting you were wrong about a fact. It means dismantling a structure that has been load-bearing. It means confronting the possibility that who you think you are was partly built from something that was never real, and most people would rather protect the construction than face what stands beneath it. Think about something you remember clearly, something important, something that shaped a decision you made, a belief you hold, a relationship you entered or left, something you consider foundational. Now hold it. And ask yourself, not whether it feels real, but how you know. How do you know the emotional weight attached to it is proportional to what actually occurred? How do you know the details your mind supplies weren't filled in during one of the thousands of times you've reconstructed the event? How do you know the interpretation you attached to it? The meaning you drew from it is the interpretation that fits what actually happened, rather than the one that fit who you needed to be at the moment you needed it. You may not be able to answer that. And that uncertainty is not weakness. That uncertainty is the beginning of wisdom. The mind is not a vault. It is a canvas, and every memory is a brushstroke. Some are painted by experience, fully formed, as close to accurate as the imperfect instrument of human perception allows. Some are painted by suggestion, a word introduced at the right moment, a story heard at a vulnerable time, a narrative repeated until it became indistinguishable from the landscape of your actual life. And some are painted by something you may never be able to identify. Something you encountered without knowing you were encountering it. Something that found its way onto the canvas while you were looking somewhere else. There is a version of this realization that leads somewhere dark, that makes the whole exercise of memory, of self-knowledge, of personal history, feel futile. If the past can be rewritten, why trust any of it? If identity is built on reconstructions, what is left to trust? That response is understandable. But it is also, in a quiet way, exactly what the people who understand these mechanisms are counting on. Because a person who has lost faith in their own perception is not more resistant to manipulation. They are less. Radical uncertainty creates a vacuum, and vacuums are filled by whoever is loudest, by whoever is most consistent, by whoever offers the clearest and most emotionally satisfying version of what is real. The goal is not to distrust your memory entirely. The goal is to hold it differently, to carry it with the kind of open-handed awareness that can acknowledge uncertainty without being paralyzed by it. To be able to say, I believe this to be true, and I am aware that I could be wrong, and I am remaining open to evidence that would require me to update. That is not weakness. That is the only posture from which genuine understanding is possible. The most dangerous lies are not the ones you are told. They are the ones you remember. Because the ones you are told, you can examine. You can question. You can decide to believe or disbelieve based on what the evidence actually says. But the ones you remember feel like evidence themselves. They feel like the ground. And the ground is supposed to be the one thing that doesn't move. This has been Whispers from the Dark. I'm Raven Vale. And the next time you reach into the dark for something you're certain is there, ask yourself, who put it there? And whether it was ever really yours to begin with.